5 minutes after 8. We do have a quorum. We have Representative Whitaker, Representative Fertula is coming in, Representative Smalley, and myself, Chair James. First item up this morning is SB 85, Credited Services for Temporary Employees and PERS. Senator Mackey and Representative Cowdery, Bill. Representative Cowdery, are you presenting this bill today? Oh, okay. Jeannie is?
Wrong bill.
Okay. I wondered Jeannie. Where Mackey came into this.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not reading too good. My eyes are seeing double.
Good.
Anyway,
even.
Good morning.
Good morning. I'm Jeannie Smith for Senator Mackey. Senate Bill 85 is a familiar piece of legislation. It's actually been around several times since 1992. Became more important as the departments try to minimize the impact of downsizing. And this is a simple mechanism to cut personnel costs. Currently, the temporary employees in the PERS system can buy back their temporary time. However, it doesn't count towards their minimum service needed for retirement. And this amends the statutes that would allow them to buy up their temporary time and have it credited. It amends the statutes by adding also a public service benefit that entitles a person to a retirement benefit if they had at least 2 years of paid up PERS service and a total of at least 5 years of combined PERS and TERS retirement service. When the Department of Education switched from PERS to TERS years ago, the employees that were in PERS were not able to count that time towards a retirement, so they got caught in the middle there. The temporary service under the retirement system provides that the full actuarial cost of using this temporary service be paid by the employee, and there are absolutely no general funds involved in the proposal. There's a $4,000 designated fund source as the public employees retirement system for computer modifications. And the legislation will allow the state to realize immediate cost savings by enabling employees to meet the retirement eligibility threshold sooner. The employees prone to use this are in the Tier 1 system, and the employees that would be replacing them generally would be the Tier 2 and Tier 3. And not only are their steps lower, but the costs that are in relation to the supplemental benefit and the retirement system are substantially lower to the cost of to the state to have those employees. We introduced this legislation at the request of several Kodiak constituents, but like I said, it has been around, and we've received the support of several Alaskan workers from throughout the state of Alaska. And we've got a lot of support letters and letters from the AFL-CIO and the Teamsters. Senate Bill 85 is a responsible piece of the puzzle in the development of Alaska's long-term budget system. It's a easy, simple remedy, and it's a responsible economic tool that can be used to minimize the impact of downsizing state government. Any questions?
Any questions of the sponsor? Hearing none. Appreciate you bringing this bill before us, and we'll just move on then to the testimony that we have here. I wanted to tell Guy Bell, I think he works in this committee. He's here all the time. But we'll go to some others first before we get to you, Guy. Earl Clark. Morning. Tell us who you are and why you're here.
This is a soft seat. I try to avoid soft seats. My name is Earl Clark. I live at 9163 Parkwood in Juneau, Alaska. I was recruited late in my career to come to the University of Alaska to help them develop the University of Alaska, Juneau. After 5.5 years, I left the university and sought my career at the state level, and I found I had a little difficulty getting a job for one reason or another. And I have about 3.5 years of part-time service with the state and 3 years and 4 months full-time service, permanent service. And I find that I have approximately 11 years of service to the state of Alaska, but I do not qualify for a retirement program. This bill will assist me in, if I pay in the funds, in qualifying for a retirement, which I would like to have. Basically, I'm a good example, I think, of how a person can get caught in the middle between two retirement systems, and this bill would attempt to rectify that.
Thank you. Any questions, Mr. Clark?
Thank you for coming forward and telling us your story.
Thank you.
Clark Damon?
Clark Damon, and I live in Douglas, just across the channel. In 72, I accepted a position with the Department of Education in Alaska, and as I recall, I would have had a similar opportunity to take the same position in other states, but at the time, Alaska planned for the trade industrial supervisor position I took was, in my idea of a philosophy, in a way which vocational education and career education should be delivered. So I had the responsibility of the K through adult responsibilities with the community colleges, with the union training programs, as well as the high schools. And in addition, I was a VA approving officer for the Veterans Administration under contract with the Department of Education. I've had the opportunity to talk with a number of you people and your aides, and a question that has been thrown at me is that I knew the rules of retirement, why didn't I stick around? And I think, if I think about it, the way that question was phrased, it means to me that the retirement programs probably are more of a disincentive than they are an incentive for people to progress and to work with the state of Alaska. And that the state has, I understand, 6 different retirement programs, and transferability between the programs are quite impossible in many cases. As I left the Department of Education, and after 3.5 approximately years, at that point, the department was reorganized. The manpower training function was moved to the Department of Community and Regional Affairs. The VA approving office responsibilities were moved to the new post-secondary commission. And I often think back is that before that happened, two of us in the Department of Education was doing the student financing and the VA approval, and shortly after they established that post-secondary commission, they had 20 people doing our jobs. So I think that's an example of a reorganization. I then took a position with the Department of Highways as a training officer, and during that phase, the Department of Public Facilities and Department of Highways was merged together, and as training officer, I had responsibility with 3,500 state employees, and I guess I witnessed retirement programs in action. A number of people had many years in service, and they had to stick it out, so to say, because they couldn't afford to make a move. And as I recall, I assume the production probably could have been greater. What I've done, and I think I've talked to many of you, is that when I realized that the state was exempt from ERISA, the United States Employment Retirement Income Security Act, which requires the private sector to invest its employees within 5 years, I assumed that would apply to the state, so I didn't think or worry about it until my hair got real light. And I thought I'd go down and see what kind of benefit I might be eligible for. And as a result, of course, of my career, I managed to get involved in 6 different retirement programs. And this one seems to be the one that affects me under Section 375. In the study I conducted, I analyzed and researched the contributions I made, was taken from my check, and the contributions the state made. I researched the fund earnings over the 20-some years and compounded these contributions through the fund earnings until 1997, when I would have been eligible for retirement. Then I assumed that I was to receive a $606 benefit a month, which consists of $348 of health benefits and $230-some cash, which I would have been eligible for, and projected that into the future then, assuming the funds would have 8% earnings. And I found that my contributions would pay 217 months of my benefit, at which time I would be switching over to the state's contributions, and that value was over $500,000, earning about $4,000 a month. I went a step further then, as a result of some discussions with some of the staff people here, saying, why didn't I stick it out, and decided to just assume what would happen if I would have had that money and would have invested it the same way the state did, which in the years of 20-some years experience was a little over 11%. And I assumed 8% earnings, where the funds are using a higher percentage. If I didn't take a pension and would have left the money to invest when I was supposed to die at 250 months, my heirs would have $1 million. But as it is, if this bill passes, I would receive this monthly benefit, which would amount to about $151,000. And if that's the case, then when I should pass away at that point, the fund still would have approximately $750,000 left over based on the contributions on my behalf. As I evaluate the retirement programs and go through them, and I've done this, I guess, after the fact. I should have done this when I first interviewed, and I was told how great the retirement program was in Alaska compared to every place else. But I guess I'm finding out that that's not the case. As I evaluate my experiences and with the school districts and with the department, and looking at the aspects of our retirement programs, there's numerous disincentives built right into the programs. As Mr. Clark alluded, that he has less than 13 years experience with the state and still no benefit. And I believe that you'd compare the other retirement programs, you could find out a tremendous time. You could probably work for the state your career and still have probably nothing. So to give an example then how this could be a disincentive, that let's assume that we have a teacher's aide who at the same time is an aide and acquires a teaching degree. And now they have less than 5 years experience, but they have the opportunity to take a teaching position. What would you advise them to do to take that position? Would you suggest to move into the profession under TRS, where you're looking at, 2 or 3 years probation, looking at another 8 years of vesting? Or should you sit back and say, well, I better be stuck where I'm at as his aide for another year or whatever, just so I get that magical 5 years of retirement? Well, I, as a potential taxpayer, which is the way it sounds, I might be one of these days, I think that's a disincentive, that we're stifling personal goals, personal ambitions, personal training and development and improvement and experience to be locked in by some of our artificial barriers in the retirement system, if a person at the time really stops to analyze the importance that it can be in dollars and cents at the end of a career. Any questions?
No, thank you, Mr. Damon. I have been seeing Mr. Damon for a number of years here now on this issue, and appreciate him coming by. Is there anyone who has any questions for Mr. Damon? Hearing none, then I also want to put on the record that Representative Ogden, Hudson, and Green have come drifting in while we were having testimony. So we're all here now. Next one up is Vernon Marshall.
Did you want to testify or just answer questions?
We just support the bill.
Okay, fine. Guy Bell, you're on.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Guy Bell, Director of Division of Retirement Benefits. I have with me Bill Church, Retirement Systems Supervisor. The bill basically, Jeannie Smith summarized the bill very well. It does basically three things. The first is that it allows employees with temporary service to use that temporary service toward either 20 and 30 a route, depending on which branch occurs, the rent, police, fire, or other. The second part has to do with legislative employees with temporary service before 1979 that haven't yet claimed that service. This would allow them to claim that service toward a conditional retirement benefit by paying the full cost of that. There's a very small number of employees that were affected by this. That was an addition that the Senate made to this bill. And then the third item, which Mr. Clark and Mr. Damon have discussed, is the public service benefit, which would allow a person with at least 2 years of paid-up PERS service to add that with teacher's retirement system service to get to the a five-year vesting requirement in PERS to receive a benefit under the public employees retirement system. Those basically those three components. There's a very small fiscal note that Jeannie Smith mentioned, which has to do with some relatively modest computer modifications that we would need to make to our computer system, funded with non-general fund retirement system money. And that summarizes my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Anyone have any questions? Representative Logan?
Madam Chair, you know, I'm kind of amazed at seeing a lot of you guys this year. Seems to be the year of adjusting retirement of benefits. Aren't you getting concerned that we're having them have a run on the retirement system this year and setting this precedent? Everybody else, you know, gee, where's mine? I was left out, or I'm not, you know, I can't retire early. I mean, it doesn't cost anything. Why don't we just allow people to make a choice when they want to work for the state, whether or not they want to retire in 20 or 30. I mean, you know, they pay more, so what the heck? Let's just retire them out earlier. Or yeah, I just see this. I just continue to sit here in amazement at the this benevolency of state government to take care of us from cradle to grave. Is this, any comment on that?
Well, Madam Chair, Representative Logan, there's basically, I would categorize the legislation this year basically in two or three pieces. The first is that the Division of Retirement Benefits did submit through Representative Hudson retirement system cleanup bill that just had to do with administrative efficiencies of the system. And a bill that has been waiting for a long time from our perspective and being introduced and we hope passed this year. The other aspect of it is the ability of employees to, certain categories of employees to pay to go from a 30 and up to a 20 and up program, and those would include bills relating to police dispatchers, to correctional non-certificated correctional officers, and then there's some other categories too. And that would require those employees to pay the full actuarial cost. So from the retirement system's perspective, whether they're city employees or state employees or you know, or whatever. That there's no cost to the retirement system to doing that because it, effectively it's up to the employee to pay that full cost, either by paying up front or by paying it over time through a reduction in their benefit. And really those are the two general types. This piece of legislation is slightly different, but again, the only section that would have a fiscal impact has been addressed by requiring the employees to pay the full cost. And the temporary service is certainly service for their employer, whether it be the state of Alaska or another employer in the public employees retirement system. They have still worked for that employee for 20 or 30 years. It just happened that a certain amount of their time was temporary time, and this allows them to pay the cost to attribute that temporary time towards that 20 or 30 and out. They certainly put in the years in total.
Madam Chair, if I follow. I was here for the bills. I knew what they did. I guess my question is, don't you guys I mean, am I the only one in the room that sees a run of these things coming? I mean, we've got, and I'm concerned that from a policy level, this committee, that we're getting pretty easy. And I guess, let me ask you this. This, would you characterize this as, okay, this gentleman here made a decision to change careers, and now he's asking us to retroactively vest him in the first retirement that he didn't get vested in. I mean, is that a fair characterization?
That's I think it's a fairly fair characterization, sure.
And do you have any idea how many, if I might follow up, Madam Chair?
Go ahead.
How many people this could affect? I mean, there's got to be more people that maybe made career decisions early on and worked for one outfit in TERS or whatever and then switched over to the PERS later on. I mean, do you have any idea how many people?
We did do a count. We basically went into our computer system and looked at people with paid-up service in PERS who had less than 5 years, and also with TERS service, but with combined service, a total of 5 years, and we counted 22 people. So it's a very small number, obviously, out of 60 or 70,000 in the system that are affected by the public service benefit. Very small.
If I might, just on that, were you in here when Mr. Damon was testifying?
Yes.
One of the green sheets. If you listen to the, I just wanted to, this is on this point, listen to his numbers. He took his own contributions out of his check and the contributions that the state made in matching that and projected it out to see what those on deposit would earn. It was a huge amount of money that the retirement system kept of what I consider to be his money if he isn't able to do this. I think, maybe that's what we want to do. I have a little problem with that whole procedure is if you're not there enough, all you've paid in and goes away. My one time that I ever worked with retirement for a private, when I left before it was time, I got my money back. I didn't get the money back that the company put in, but I got my money back at least.
Representative James, you would get your money back and a relatively small component of interest back. You don't get the employer's money back. The state retirement systems, the PERS and the TERS, work the same way. An employee, Mr. Damon, could have refunded his contributions, but he chose not to do so effectively because he feels that he would get a much more valuable benefit through the passage of this legislation because then he gets the benefit of the defined benefit formula, which is funded not just by his contributions but by the contributions his employer makes.
And isn't it true, though, that the contributions that the employee makes is part of it, considered to be part of his wages?
The employee's contribution is a deduction from the employee's salary.
Barry, you want to go on? Did you have another follow-up?
Lost my train of thought. Sorry.
Okay, Representative Whitaker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to follow up on the point that was being discussed, the employer contribution would stay in the system given that the employee chose to take their employee contribution plus interest out. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. Benevolence has to pick up on a term that was utilized earlier. Benevolence has an inherent notion of cost associated with it. And I think that it may not be appropriately used because it appears to me that there is no cost to the system or to the state. And could you clarify that, please?
Just with the public service benefit, Representative Whitaker, effectively what happens when a person leaves early and does not receive cashes out, does not receive a retirement benefit, is that the system gains. The fund makes the gains from those contributions that the employer made. Those gains are effectively used to fund other people's benefits, people who are vested in a benefit. So effectively, it's like a windfall, which and the way that windfalls effectively spin through the system is that over time, if the windfall builds up, if investment earnings are greater than anticipated, it can eventually bring down employer rates. So it effectively goes to the benefit of employers in the system over time, bringing down their rates. With this one, effectively, what we're doing is that it's effectively taking that windfall and reducing it by a small amount, because these people are effectively going to be getting a benefit who would not otherwise have received one. So a portion of that windfall has been wiped out through this with the passage of this legislation.
Follow up, Lydia.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there an estimate as to the amount of that windfall reduction as relates to the 22 people in question?
Senator Whitaker, in our fiscal note, we did do an estimate of that, and we looked at it between public employees and teachers' retirement systems, because we would draw the money both from PERS and TERS, public employees and teachers' retirement systems. We measured it as less than $700,000. Now, $700,000 may sound like this is over the lifetime of these people. So basically, it's a net present value of their future benefits. And that's out of a fund assets and liabilities of about $12 billion. So it's 0.007% of the assets or liabilities of the system. We've indicated that, yes, there is a very small cost, $700,000, but it has no impact on the funding status of the system or on employer rates, because it is such a small portion of the total fund.
Okay, so the cost of the benevolence is what percentage?
0.001%.
Okay, Representative Hudson.
Thank you. Trying to reflect my memory here, Guy. The trigger in both the PERS and the TERS program is the period of vesting, how many years it takes to vest. And 5 years in the PERS program, both the employer and the employee contribute into the investment portfolio for the PERS program. When the employee leaves premature, say 4 years, 3 years, that employee has an opportunity to withdraw his or her funds plus the interest that's accrued on it, and is no longer then affiliated, has no value within that trust fund. What happens to the employer's contribution at that point? Let's say that I'm an employee and I work, I'm in a PERS program and I work for 3 years and I terminate. During those 3 years, I've put in my money and the employer, the state of Alaska, has put in their money. I get my money back with interest. What happens to the balance of it?
Each employer, and we have 100 and some employers in the retirement system, Municipality of Anchorage, Fairbanks, and so on, the contributions made by each employer go to the employer's account, a separate account effectively in the public employee's retirement system. And those contributions effectively stay with that employer's account.
Do they offset that employer's contribution, generally speaking, then?
Over time, Representative Hudson, what our actuaries do is they compare the assets of the employer, how much money they have built up over time, with their expected liabilities, and that is compared. Those are compared to develop a rate for that employer. So effectively, they're credited to the employer's account to be used for future benefits. Well, and obviously, it's not for this employee who withdrew his or her money. It's for some other employee. It's for some other employee who in the future will receive retirement benefit.
If we pass this legislation through the chair, we will be establishing a precedent where any future employee fitting into the same category that works, say, were in the teaching system for, say, 5 years but weren't vested and came over and worked for 2 years in the into any one of the state jobs, would essentially be able to do the very same thing that we're talking about here, because of the parity. The precedent applies to 22 people today, but essentially it does mean that from here on out, anybody else who falls into that category will have a legal recourse in order to essentially say, well, I'll pay that difference
and I want to switch everything into PERS. I want to take my TERS time and money and put it into PERS and get my retirement from there on out. Is that correct?
Representative Hudson, yes, that's correct. There is no sunset clause for that provision, so this provision would be permanent. And that, as opposed to people who in the past, for whatever reason, either didn't know the impact of the decisions they had made on their potential benefit, or they thought they may have come back into PERS and have gotten that 5 years, people can now, I would say, plan, make their plans based on this, because this would effectively become a permanent part of the law.
And I point that out, Madam Chair, because this is a policy question beyond the people who are in it right at the present time. It will be effective from here on out.
Well, I agree with that. And the other thing I've been thinking about since the last time that we were talking, and so that if they're not vested, they could take their money out, and then the rest of the money just remains there, and whether or not that's part of their employment contract, so to speak, or their but that part that's there, because there is a time for vesting, is to encourage people to stay. Isn't that correct? And if they don't stay, then, of course, they don't get the benefit. It's not necessarily a part of their day-to-day employment. It is just a carrot for them to stay. And if you stay long enough, you can get this on top of what you're already getting.
Madam Chair, that's correct. There's one other issue, too, and that's that if you have immediate vesting in a system, it would be very costly, because if you stuck around one day and then could be eligible for retirement benefits at age 65, medical benefits at age 65, that would be very costly.
Well, I understand that. I understand that whole argument. In fact, I've been thinking back about the system that I was in for 10 years, and I had to stay either 15 years or till I was 55, or I didn't get any of it. I mean, there was no early vesting. You had to be there either for 15 years or 55, and I think you couldn't even do it till you're 55. And I stayed 10 years and I left, took my money and ran. Representative Ogden.
Madam Chair. Okay, let me get this straight. If someone made a decision to leave the TERS system because of a career opportunity that before they got vested, do you think it's the state's responsibility to retroactively vest them?
Representative Ogden, the theory behind this legislation is that if a person has 5 years total service, or more than 5 years total service combined between PERS and TERS, and it's paid up, that employee and their employer have contributed sufficient money to the system that a benefit should be funded. And it should be called a public service benefit. It should be a benefit that's paid for by both systems. Because effectively, with that 5 years of time in, that person should then be entitled to receive some benefit. And that's the policy question that this bill raises, really.
Follow up.
I understand what that does. I guess. I'm looking at the people that maybe didn't make a decision to move on to a higher paid job in a different bureaucracy or whatever. They decided to hang in there, but they didn't get vested for some reason. Maybe they, I just think there's an issue of fairness here. Maybe they took a job in the private sector, after they got hired. I mean, are we going to go back and say, well, gee, they kicked that money in, let's just go ahead and retroactively change that back to 5 years. I mean, I suppose we could do that, then they'd be vested in the system. I mean, I just see this trend coming where, everybody wants theirs. I mean, I think we're heading down a real slippery slope. I guess that's maybe a statement more than a question, because you're not here to make policy. You're here to tell us how the policy will affect the system. I understand that, but I'm kind of putting you on the spot. But
did you have any response to that?
I think it's
more of a statement than a question. I think it's, yeah, okay. Representative Whitaker?
Well, I think I'll make a statement as well as a question, Madam Chair. And that is that I will agree with my counterpart to the right that this is a question of fairness. And I suppose it determined from one's perspective, but these individuals have contributed. The employee has contributed on their behalf. The system is receiving a windfall, acknowledged, rather than the individual accruing that benefit. And I think it truly is a question of fairness, and we need to be fair to these individuals. I support the legislation and would like to see it move, Madam Chair.
On that point, do people not that, say, work for the state or TERS less than the amount of time that it takes to get vested, they also contribute that they never get the money? Is that also a windfall?
Representative Roy, you're talking about people in the teacher's retirement system who just stay in the teacher's retirement system for less than the vesting period?
Yeah, or the PERS. I mean, it doesn't matter. I mean, my wife worked for the state for 3 years. She contributed. She's got about $12,000 in there. She's not vested. She never doesn't continue to work for the state. She doesn't get the money, right? That's a windfall, correct?
She got her money back that she put in?
Not out of PERS. She got it out of SBS, but not PERS.
Representative Bowman, she can withdraw her own contributions to PERS at any time, or she can return into a PERS position, and if she eventually vests in the PERS system, then she would be eligible for benefits. So there is that future, let's call it carrot, that a person returned to a PERS position and then could get vested in benefits.
But the state contribution becomes a windfall to the PERS.
Representative Logan, for all those people that don't reach the vesting requirement effectively, yes, that is built into our funding of the system, that we're expecting that some people will turn over and that will then reduce the overall cost of everyone else's benefits.
Okay, one more question, and I'll be done. And this nice gentleman that testified before could take his contribution out of TERS. He could have done that at any time.
Representative Logan, yes, that's correct.
He chose not to.
That's correct.
Okay, thanks. I rest my case.
Any other questions? Okay, we have some people. Thank you. We have some people. Jeannie, did you want to say something?
Yeah.
Before we go to the teleconference?
I just wanted to say that this whole thing started back in 1980 when the Blue Ribbon Commission on Personnel did a report, and they made the decision that the state was ripping off its employees, and they were demanding equity. If you remember back in the legislature days, we had temporary 19s and 15s, we had permanent 21s and 15s, and there was no fairness because you could be year-round temporary. But we did that to get so that people could keep their payroll going and more people could keep working and stuff like that. So it was a Blue Ribbon Commission that originally recommended this change.
Thank you.
Yeah, Representative.
Where in the legislation is that fix?
It is at that time.
In the bill itself.
In the bill,
yeah.
It's partially there. The part that is there is where they were allowed to buy their temporary time back, but they didn't add that it would count to their retirement eligibility. So that was the part that was fixed originally.
There's something in this bill, and I confess I haven't had a chance to go over it thoroughly in here, that takes care of that temporary service, and I'm just trying to find it in the bill.
Yeah, well, the whole intent behind the bill is it's actually the next layer. The first layer that they corrected was they allowed them to buy back their eligibility. This one allows that, buy back their benefits. This one allows them to meet their eligibility threshold. So it's the second part of that. Yeah.
But then it also allows them to put the two TERS and PERS together, which hadn't been available.
And like that's another increment. That was done when department went from TERS to PERS, PERS to TERS. The thing is that in this whole issue, as I did the research and stuff, this is the downsizing tools that the entire country are using. This is a way to minimize the impact, and a lot of the personnel systems are doing just this.
Thank you. Thank you, Sandy. We could go to teleconference now. In Kodiak, we have Jeff Barnhart.
Yes. Good morning, committee members. My name is Jeff Barnhart. I urge you to vote yes on SB 85. In 1999, the legislature asked the people of Alaska to bring forth ideas that would provide cost savings for the state, and SB 85 does exactly that. I have like a year and a half of temporary time that I worked in the 70s, and this bill would allow me to claim that temporary time that I've already worked towards my retirement eligibility. Also, the administration has determined there are no costs associated with this bill, and in fact, it does provide a cost savings to the state of Alaska. I urge you to support this bill and pass it out of committee today due to the shortness of the legislative session. In the words of the bill sponsor, Jerry Mackey, it is the right thing to do. That concludes my statement. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Mr. Barnhart. We have Joe DiNincenzo.
Good morning, committee members. I also am a state employee, work here in Kodiak, and I'm not sure if this bill would benefit me or not, but it definitely will provide an incentive for some longtime employees to retire early with what they've already with an increased retirement benefit they've already paid for. I think it's the right thing to do morally, and I think it'll save the state money. You've been looking for ideas to save money and bridge the fiscal gap. I think this is a good, positive way to do it. So I urge you to do whatever you need to do to get this through and pass this year. Thank you.
Thank you. And now we go to Seward, Louis Bencardino.
Thank you for a chance to represent some of the employees of the city of Seward. Back in 75, 76, we had CETA employees, and when the city went with PERS, they didn't pick up those employees back time because they claimed that they were temporary hire, even though they worked 40 hours a week, pulled shifts by themselves. You know, they were considered a permanent employee in every respect. Now, we have five employees ranging from 3 months to 2 years that have this time. They're still working for the city. I would really appreciate it if there's some way that we could pick up those people's back time in this bill. And that's what I'd like to bring before the committee today.
Thank you. Jeannie, did you hear what he is? Does this affect the people he's talking about?
Yes, and there are...
He'll come forward so that you're on the tape.
There are, surprisingly enough, a couple hundred vendors that are cities and municipalities that are under the PERS system as well. This isn't just for state employees, so it is a mechanism for them to have savings in their budgets as well by letting some of their long-term employees retire, by giving them the eligibility to retire.
I guess one of the things that I have to say here, because my something nags at me at the back of my head, that getting rid of all of these employees that have been around for a while is going to save us money doesn't necessarily translate. I'm one of the people who believe that when people are around longer, it's not always the case, are better at what they do, and that we benefit by the reason why we pay them more. So I know that is the general trend, is if we can get some of these more expensive people to quit and hire in some less expensive people, and we do have another tier of retirement that is not as generous as before, that there will be some cost savings. You can't measure the cost savings or the costs necessarily on training new people to do the job.
And there is an expense there that's not recognized here. So,
well,
but I'm not going to oppose this bill for that
purpose.
But I just want to put it on the record that I don't necessarily buy in to the idea that getting rid of expensive employees and hiring cheaper ones is a savings.
Yeah,
by
it's
itself.
Up to them to make that decision. They get to decide. They don't. It's not a mechanism that forces them to do so.
Okay, thank you. We have in Anchorage, Michael Dean.
Good morning, Madam Chair, committee members. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. My name's Mike Dean. I'm currently employed with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. I've been a state employee for over 23 years. I've had the opportunity of 18 of those years to be residing in Juneau, where Representative Hudson was my representative at the time. I'm currently here in Anchorage, in the south end of Anchorage. This bill would allow me to take my almost 2 years of temporary time that I have bought back in the early 1980s and use it to reach my eligibility threshold for retirement. Like I said, I would take that 2 years out of the 23 years I already have in state service. It's already paid for, and be able to reach that eligibility threshold when this bill becomes effective. I'd like to thank the committee member for hearing this bill today and urge that they expedite it as quickly as possible to get it through the House as soon as they can. Thank you very much.
Is there any other comments or is there anyone left here that wanted to testify on this bill here in Juneau? Is there anyone out there on teleconference that wanted to testify on this bill that hasn't had an opportunity yet? Hearing none, then we'll close public testimony and hear what the committee has to say about this bill. Yes, Representative Hudson.
Well, Madam Chair, having looked at all of the fiscal implications and the fact that there is no cost to the employer, one policy which I really appreciate in here, and I guess it was added to this legislation over on the other side, is the application to all temporary accredited service. You know, that is an area that over the years I've observed where people who say, didn't want to work for the administration but had a loyalty to the legislative process, whether it be legislative, finance, legal, or whatever else, have taken these jobs and have been able to get back their money that they pay into the thing but never be able to use those part-time job applications as an accrual towards retirement. So I think, and I was able to locate that, and it's right in the Section 1, so I felt good about that. From a policy perspective, since this has a very limited application, I feel some sympathy towards the people, the 22 people who are in between two systems here, and they've contributed to both of them. That is, they've put their money in and they've put their time in, albeit in two different systems, and I'm inclined to support this legislation for those two reasons. One, because it takes care of the temporary employees. It does provide them the opportunity to accrue retirement benefits for that period of time, and I've always thought that was the right thing to do. And from a policy perspective, as long as this costs no extra money, I would prefer that it have some sort of a deeper look at some point in time to when we could, you know, from a long term. So, because when you do this, you're setting in motion an opportunity for employees for the next 20, 30, 40, 50 years, unless and when we revisit this subject here. For those who are already in the thing, it's great, and I can support that. I might have preferred to have had a sunset date on the thing so that we would take care of all of those people who were caught in between, and then make certain that all future employees knew that they had to choose one or the other. But this bill doesn't do that, and I certainly wouldn't hold the bill up for that purpose. So I'm supporting the bill, and I'll be ready to make a motion whenever you're ready for one.
Any other comments? Go ahead.
Madam Chair, I move Committee Substitute Senate Bill Number 85 rules with the fiscal note attached from this committee with individual recommendations. I would ask unanimous consent.
Any objection? Hearing none, then the bill is moved. I'll take a brief study. up, we have House Bill 444. And we have staff here for Representative Cowdery. Would you tell us who you are and tell us about the bill?
Yes, my name is Annette Steele. I'm staff to Representative Cowdery. House Bill 444 requires state agencies to annually list which of their activities are not inherently governmental. Inherently governmental function is defined as a function that is so closely related to the public interest that it requires performance by state governmental employees. Section 2C of the bill contains several paragraphs of elaboration for this definition. Okay, so what does this mean? You have two things. You have inherently governmental functions and you have not inherently governmental functions. Let's use the court system as an example. Obviously, our judicial branch is inherently governmental. They make decisions that bind our state, our lives, our liberty. However, the support staff that collects the fees, records the transcripts, and gathers the information, they are not inherently governmental. So House Bill 444, first of all, requires each state agency to identify the activities that are not inherently governmental in nature on a list. Secondly, upon decision to outsource an activity by the agency, it requires consideration of all realistic and fair costs of government agency performance when comparisons are made with private sector costs. Interested persons may challenge the inclusion or omission of an activity on the list. A challenge and appeal process is defined in the bill. While a modest requirement, making a list is an important first step. House Bill 444 does not mandate any type of privatization, but does provide the basis for long-term, consistent efforts toward cost-effective government. Also provided for you is Public Law 105-270. It is the Federal Activities Inventory Reform Act, known as FARA. It passed Congress in 1998 and was signed into law by President Clinton in October of that year. House Bill 444 is a mirror of this law, only it applies on a state level. Since 98, federal departments have complied with this requirement, and these lists are online available to the public. There have been challenges to the list by employees, private industry, and unions. These challenges and appeals work through the process, and often the decision is reversed upon the gathering of new information. I recently spoke with the OMB office in D.C., and they're very enthusiastic about this process so far. Currently, they have an amendment in Congress that would take the FAIR legislation one step further. They would like to have all activities included on the list, whether they're inherently governmental or non-inherently governmental. They believe this allows the private sector to make informed decisions. There is currently no easy way for individuals to figure out what omissions from the list are. House Bill 444, however, does not go that far. It simply requires a list be made of the non-inherently governmental activities. This allows future policymakers to become more informed. It is merely the first step in making intelligent decisions about government services.
Okay. Any questions of the sponsor? Representative Smalley.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I noticed a note in our packet that there hadn't yet been received a fiscal note. Do you have any idea of what the fiscal note might be?
We have not heard from any of the administration as to what the fiscal note may be.
Do you have any idea what the fiscal note was on the federal law?
I'm not positive of that. I do know, however, that House Bill 444 only requires a list to be made. So in the missions and measures, some departments are already identifying which services are non-governmental. They're already starting to go in this avenue, but this takes it one step further as to where it provides access to the public and it allows unions and employees to challenge the decision.
Any other questions, Representative Ogun?
Was the fiscal note requested in a timely manner?
Last Friday.
Madam Chair, the chairman has authority if the administration is dropping the ball on a fiscal note to issue one. I recommend, and maybe I'll move that we just go ahead and issue a zero one. Maybe that'll get your attention.
Okay.
governor always issues zero fiscal notes to things he wants passed. So I guess no fiscal notes to things he doesn't support. I guess there's a motion on the table.
Okay, the motion is that we prepare a zero fiscal note for this piece of legislation. Is there any objection?
Not a chair.
Representative Whitaker?
If we're going to make that decision, could I have a brief at ease, perhaps 2 minutes, to think about it?
Well, quite frankly, I think it is the chair's prerogative to do that or not. I certainly believe that the committee can mandate or tell me they want me to do this. So I think
I'll withdraw the motion then, Madam Chair, and request that you issue a fiscal note. It does have a finance referral, and I think that would give the administration adequate time to come up with a fiscal note for next hearing.
Is your motion withdrawn?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I would also like to note that we don't have any evidence that the administration is against this. As far as we know, they were very cooperative when the Commission on Privatization did its studies, and also they work with the Finance Committee on a regular basis in performing the missions and measures, which, as I stated earlier, do include some core governmental activities being defined already.
Any other questions or comments? Representative Cartula.
Thanks. I'm just trying to think of examples and where people would come in, and I'm a little wondering how this is going to work. Can you tell me where would attorneys fit into this? Where would Department of Law fit in? And let me say why this is bothering me. I see the section that talks about the interpretation or execution of the laws, and then I see the section over on page 3 at line 14 that talks about gathering information for providing advice, opinions, recommendations, or ideas. So it looks to me like they fit in both places.
Through the chair, Representative Cotula, I believe that each department is responsible for making the decision on their own, and then the attorneys have the right, if they don't agree with it, to challenge that. That's the checks and balances. However, in my opinion, I think that if an attorney makes a decision that binds the state in an economic matter, military action, it affects the life, liberty, or property, then that is a inherently governmental function.
Thanks, if I could follow up. What about if I've got a legal assistant, though, that's going out and getting me the information that's necessary to provide that advice? Where would they fall under that?
To the Chair of Senator Cartula, there is delegatory authority. The person responsible for ultimately making that decision is the person who is inherently governmental. If that person delegates authority to somebody else to gather information, that's all that person is doing is gathering information. They are not making a decision that binds the economic or the life of another person.
So they wouldn't be inherently governmental?
I don't believe they would be.
So you could wind up in a situation where you'd have Department of Law attorneys being governmental, but you'd have everybody that worked with them not. Thanks.
In response to that issue, and what I'm thinking of, what I'm visualizing in this case is people who have companies that provide staff, is private industries do that, and in some cases they're very, very successful, and they have specific types of people. The problem with that, of course, is that they change jobs a lot. And if they're working for a private industry and they have a contract with some, well, let's just talk about BP in Anchorage, who had a contract for people to do their payroll. I believe it was them. And different big companies will have an outside firm that does the payroll. That's all they do is they do the payroll. There's no job guarantee whatsoever for those folks, because all of a sudden the company can decide they're going to do it differently, or they're going to not need so many or whatever. And knowing of friends of mine over the years, and even people I have hired to work for me, who work for what they call temporary placement or even full-time placement,
do a lot of moving. They don't generally stay on the same job for a long time. So there's certainly a benefit for hiring those people, mostly because of all of the benefits that are paid by the company that they work for as opposed to this company. And over the years, we've used those kind of companies an awful lot. They're still being used an awful lot. And many times you don't know who their paycheck is coming from. And what surprises me, and being in a tax preparation business, having people who I thought worked for a company who don't, they work for someone else. Felix Services is one of the ones that I can think of that we're contracting almost all the work at Clear Air Station. And so even though it was government work, it was contracted out to a company. And some of the companies up on the North Slope also provide people to work. And so I think that if that's what we're talking about here, which I think maybe it might be, I think there certainly is an advantage of identifying those kinds of jobs who could be provided by some kind of a company who provides manpower. Representative Green.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. As I read lines 14 and 15 on page 2 in answer to what is concerned, it seems to me that that would remain in the judgment of the agency. And if those legal assistants were in that agency's judgment working either yes or no, that decision would be made at the behest of that agency. So it wouldn't create the problem I think you were foreseeing.
President Curtula.
Through the chair, I mean, but we've got a definition of what inherently governmental activity is here that I think is just going to be extremely difficult to figure out. I mean, I just see how this is just going to go in big circles. And I think the sponsor's trying to get at, you know, getting the correct kind of information from the agencies. But I think that if what we mean is staff versus, I don't know, decision-making responsibilities, maybe it would be clearer to do something like that, because I think you're going to find yourself in big arguments internally about what is and isn't. And I guess with the example of attorneys in particular, it just won't work. If you have attorneys being hired by the state, you have staff not, you have the problem the chair's speaking of with people coming in and out. So I was just trying to seek some clarity, and I'm afraid it is going to be confusing.
Representative Hudson?
Thank you. I look at the section 446450 on page 4, line 29, as the principal purpose behind this legislation, in that it would provide, contrary to almost every labor contract that we probably have signed with the unions at the moment, at any rate, an alternative way of privatizing positions in state government. So at the beginning of this legislation, essentially directs the administration and OMB as their backup to list every position that works for them that, following the decision or the description in the legislation, to list everyone who doesn't fit within this inherent government activity, to essentially, I guess, be declared sort of a free position outside above the labor contracts control, wherein I know from my own experience with them, they protect quite deeply all people who work for them. And so then if you get on over to page 4, line 9, you see that there's a challenge and an appeal section in there to where individuals can appeal the fact that their job has been listed outside of the governmental realm and therefore is susceptible to be literally bid out. And I look at that. And so then if you go on down to the procurement and listed activity, in my way of thinking, that's the nut of this whole thing. That now that you've got this list of non-governmental employees, all of those positions are no longer in a protected class if
the, I suppose, the legislature or the administration or anybody else wanted to simply contact them out. And I'd like to know if that's, if I'm reading this correctly, because I believe I am.
Well, I think you are, Representative Hudson. I think there is, I'll let the sponsor respond to that, but it seems to me like that is the issue. And I, you know, as painful as it might be to discuss this issue, I think it's extremely important that we discuss this issue. And certainly, whenever you're doing anything with people and their lives and their ability to make a living and to get the job done, it's very, very sensitive. And so we need to be absolutely sure that we're doing our job and in that respect. Would you like to respond to his issue?
Mr. Representative Hudson, the unions are generally opposed when services are transferred to the private sector. However, when they have the chance to bid at the same level and with the same criteria as private industry, they usually do not oppose that. And what it does is it creates more efficient, effective government, and the quality of service that is being performed goes up.
Yes, Representative Calgary.
The gist of this legislation is to have activities listed. That's all it is. It's a list that requires the non-governmental activities be listed. So it's not any one person's job. It's a type of job, a type of service, and activity that is performed. And no outsourcing is required, no privatization. It is the agency's decision if they would like to take building maintenance and outsource it, or the electrical work that we do in the building, if they would like to take that scope of their work and outsource it. So,
Representative Hudson?
Yeah, and I understand that, and that's nothing novel or new. We do that when I was Commissioner of Administration. We put many of the works that were temporary in nature, were not like a permanent function of government or something like that, out, and we have that in the contract. I remember writing that directly into the contract, and the unions didn't like that, but we put it in there that in any time that management wanted to contract out those services, and they said, okay, providing that you can show that it costs less than it would be to have a state employee do it. So we got that language in there. That was a give up on their part, and it was a give up on our part, but it left the administration. And I bet you, if you looked at the level of contracting out, privatization that already goes on in state government, you'd find that it's pretty, it's pretty big. If this is only trying to identify, what government's doing, then I think it would be one thing. In fact, I believe that our entire budgeting process this last year, I've been watching it, is essentially doing that. Every budget that comes before each subcommittee, those directors are having to put down the missions and measurements and all that type of stuff.
And I would presume, at any rate, if there's things in there that should be privatized out, that nothing in the labor contracts, and we can ask the union people here, would deny our opportunity to do that. So I think we already have it.
I'm visualizing here because now we're in an area of my background and my expertise in business consulting and payroll and all of the various different things that I have done. And, you know, one of the problems that I see, even when we spent a lot of money to do a comparison between state employees and other people out there, it's very difficult to find the job qualifications, the comparison of what they do and how they do it. This would provide that by saying what the jobs that are done. I think, you know, as painful as it might be and as concerned as other folks are and as concerned as the union is, that this would be a good idea. It's my personal belief that an awful lot of the people who are working for the state currently, for the wages they're currently working for, you could not find a private industry to come in and provide those services. That's my personal opinion. This would be available to the general public. The general public doesn't have a clue what goes on in government. All they know is it's a big bureaucracy that costs just an eighth of a lot of money, and they think it's unnecessary. If this did nothing more except to inform the general public about what goes on in government and allows them to take a better look at it, it would be worth the money, I think, to be able to do that.
And through the chair, that is the basis of this legislation, is to create a list of the activities and to provide it to the public for them to review. And just like with OMB on the federal level, they want all of the activities that the government performs on the list, because omission of it, and we don't know what we as the public don't know where to go to gather information to figure out what they're doing. And reading the budget, even though missions and measures, the finance department is moving in this direction, it is almost impossible for a layman to read the budget.
Thank you. Okay, Representative Ogun.
Just have one comment, if I might, or ready for. Is there anybody that wants to testify?
Yes, there is.
Okay,
yes,
let's let the people testify.
Thank you.
We talk enough.
Pamela Bowl.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Pamela Bowl, and I'm president of the Alaska State Chamber of Commerce, and we are in support of House Bill 444. As you recall, over the past interim, the Privatization Commission looked into a number of issues regarding privatization. And the one thing that was unanimous amongst all the subcommittees and the committee was that understanding what is involved in a state agency's efforts, who does what jobs and what the costs are involved with those jobs is very, very difficult to find out. And it was just, it was made it nearly impossible for the commission to determine what the costs were and what could be privatized and what could not, even what the jobs were. And so this bill would go a long way toward helping create that understanding, that knowledge, make the knowledge available to the public of what jobs do state agencies do and which of those can only state agencies do and which of those could someone do for the state agency. And it leaves it to the determination of the state agency whether they would want to procure other sources for doing the job. But it has them list those things that would be involved, so it's clear and obvious. And one thing that, in regards to a comment that Representative Petula made, regarding the confusion. The federal government's doing it, and I consider us a microcosm compared to the federal government and what they do, and if they can figure it out, you know, I would think we would be able to figure this out. And it's better to do it now, while we're a small, relatively small government, than to wait 20 years down the road, and we're a much larger government, and trying to wrestle with this problem. So it just seems it was the hue and cry of the privatization commission. How can we figure out any of this when the information is there? It's too difficult to garner the information, to dig it out of what our government consists of today.
Well, thank you, Pam, for your testimony. I just, while you're waiting, I'm trying to put, because of my experience with private sector and also being exposed to government, to see the difference, because there's definitely a difference in the way they do it. And the 10 years that I spent, you know, working for corporate America, every 5 years we had to do a serious evaluation of what everybody did and how much time they spent doing it, to reevaluate the pay schedule, to reevaluate the workload, whether there was a better way to do it. Government doesn't do that. And one of the reasons that they don't, and it just came to me as I was sitting here, is that what we have is in government is we have all these state employees, which are generally referred to as the bureaucracy because they stay from one administration to another administration. This is the level of the workers. And then what you have in our system, which I'm not complaining about the system, it's an excellent system, the best I think there is on earth, is that we reelect the leaders up at the top who are politically motivated, and being politically motivated, they want to do a good job because that would then give them the credibility. But there is no, that changes. As a governor, that changes every 4 years or maybe at the maximum 8 years. And so there really is no real interest in getting to the bottom line of these issues. It never falls on the radar screen, and that's not a condemnation. It's just not part of what they do. And so I think that the legislature, and I found the first 2 weeks I was here, I had all these ideas similar to this of what we could do to make the system more effective, less costly, and whatever. And after 2 weeks, I said, I can't do that as a legislator. I'd have to be a governor. Now, I think this is proving to me that we can set in motion the rules and regulations that the administration would follow that would naturally give them their own information that they need to make those decisions, as well as being able to let the rest of the state know and the legislature know. I think this is one of the best pieces of legislation we've had to come before us. I'm very impressed. Representative Green and then Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. If we follow through this as it's written, and this actually would be to the maker of the legislation, and the OMB reviews the list, either deficient or maybe they've got too many listed, and either that person or some other person who challenges that list goes through, files an appeal, and goes through that issue. What do you see? A, do you see this as a potential for a lot of time-consuming activity of the department? Or B, do you see that this would actually ultimately perhaps provoke some sort of litigation?
Through the chair, Representative Green, I think that on the federal level, what I saw is that in their reorganization alone, they immediately saw a cost saving just in reorganizing and defining what activities were governmental and which ones were not. There is always a chance of possible litigation, and that's what the appeal process hopefully would take care of or stop. However, there's always that chance. It's just for me, my example that I've been tossing around in my head is legislative staff. Are we inherently governmental or are we not inherently governmental? Some people will say that we are because we gather information to help elected officials who are core governmental units make decisions. But some would say that we're not because we don't actually make the, we don't push the button, we don't make the decision. So I don't know, to answer your question, whether litigation would occur. It could. I don't think that it's a very, I don't think it's a large task to ask departments to identify which functions and activities should be on the list.
Thank you, Ms. Madam Chair. I wasn't thinking so much of making the list as defending the list. I was thinking that if the first pass through is done between OMB and the department, and then there's an appeal to the department on the decision, my concern was, does this tie up some body or bodies in the departments? Do you see any kind of an indication that way in the federal review of this?
Challenges are made by unions and by private sectors, and it's really, it should fall back onto my job description that I should already have, and I should say, well, I'm on that list, and I don't think I should be, and this is why. Here's my job description. This is what I do that makes me core governmental rather than non.
See, the difference between inherently governmental and not is a little cloudy to me, because it seems to me like that what really is important is who's doing that position, as how much time does it take to learn the position, and what kind of criteria that you have to do it. Now, even having said that, if you could be hired for this company over here to do it, as opposed to getting your paycheck from the government, that's kind of, I think, what we're identifying. The other thing would be that if it's not core government activities, we could stop doing it. And if it needs to be done, the private sector will pick it up. If there's something out there that needs to be done, it is not core governmental activities, then if we just don't do it, somebody else will. And then we're out of that one. And I think that's the other, I think, the area. It's not just your job classification. Is it, what is it you do? What is the net result of your activity? Is it a service? Is it informational? Whatever it is. And could somebody out there do the same thing and not even be connected? It's not talking about contracting out necessarily. I mean, it could be part of that. There could be some advantage to that. But it could also be that this is inherently not governmental and we ought not to be doing it, in which case then it becomes a policy decision. Is if we don't do it, will anyone else pick it up? And if they don't, is that a serious issue? So I think this would give the people who are managing the government a much better handle also on what government should be doing, and the legislators, either here or like at the federal level, would have a better idea of whether or not this is a good policy that they want to make, that we're going to continue to do this. So it's not really a privatization issue, but it certainly opens the door to decide what's the best way to do it.
Representative James, it's a roadmap. It's basically what it is. It starts the process here. You can go in many different directions. And privatization is such a broad word. There are so many forms of privatization, whether it's just transferring it to a different level, department, whether it's somebody takes it over on a volunteer basis, the private sector receives a contract for a year, 5 years, the government completely stops doing it. There are so many forms of privatization, and that word is really broad to use. But what House Bill 444 does is it creates a roadmap, which starts with the basic step of forming a list. All it does, forms a list. And outsourcing or contracting out is totally up to the agency, to the policymakers.
Thank you. Representative Logan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I assume we're in the stage of deliberating this measure.
I have one more person.
All right, then I'll hold up.
Jack Kreinheader.
I do have a question of her.
Oh, that's right. I'm sorry. Representative Hudson had his arm up before, and I missed him.
We, you know, historically, the big battle in government is always between, from a union, non-union point of view, has been those who are in the exempt service, because they could be hired from off the street at the will of the person who's doing the hiring. And so every department head, myself included when I was a commissioner, wanted to have as many of the positions
that I could possibly have in the exempt status, which meant that I did not have to go through the union list. And they know this. I mean, we've had many, many debates and discussions about this, because it's just something that the manager wants to have the flexibility in. This will go one major step further, because it will potentially produce a list throughout state government, throughout the 15,000 employees that we have all over the state of Alaska, and create a list of people who are not really not in a protective service whatsoever. They'll be in a union, they'll be in a job, but when they take that job, they'll have to know that that job is up for bids anytime somebody wants to come along and try to encourage that manager, that boss, you know, maybe through nepotism, even if it's second removed, that, by golly, I do have a few positions out there that I can bid out, and here's what it costs me. Would you, you know, are you able to fit within this this cost frame? And we'll have a whole lot of jobs that are working for government, for commissioners and directors and maybe even us, I don't know, that will be at risk of being outsourced out, not by virtue of any protection from the union, because this will supersede the union. The union contract will not be able to supersede this law. That's just what laws are about. And so there'll have to be an amendment to the union contract that the provisions in this law will prevail. And I guess what I'm nervous about here is that in every department, there's an awful lot of, it's a fluid thing. Every time the legislature meets, they give us new responsibilities, they take away old ones, they move them around like this, they gerrymander, if you will, you know, how government's supposed to function by virtue of the budgeting process that we have. And it just seems to me like it's going to be a like really bubbling up and down on a constant basis. Every time we get done with our work here, there's going to be a whole bunch of jobs where people thought they were working and they bought their house and they committed their kids' education and everything else. Those jobs are going to be at risk because they are going to fall into this category. We're going to list them. At this time, the lady's right. All we're doing is preparing a list. We ain't preparing that list just because we want something to do. We're preparing that list so that we will have a definition and a lot of defined jobs that are susceptible to page 5, line 6. When a state agency decides to obtain a private person to perform a listed activity, they use a competitive sealed bidding. That job at that point in time becomes the purviews of a sealed bidding process. And I think that, you know, that may be good, Madam Chairman. I'm not totally certain. I think some elements of what we're dealing with here is good. But that part of it makes me think that a lot of my neighbors, at any rate, are going to be in jobs that are potentially at risk.
In response to that, Representative Hudson, and I, you know, I'm not going to say right here that I think every line in this piece of legislation is perfect. I'm not really judging that at this point in time. I'm looking at it strictly from a policy point of view as to, and this bill is not going to be passed this year. But I, you know, from my opinion, I don't think, because of the time of it and everything and the discussion, and I don't, it has a finance referral, you know, it's in the House, it hasn't gone to the Senate yet. I think that this bill passing is very remote. However, I think the discussion we're having is very, very good, and I think the idea is very, very good. I think that any kind of idea that is like this, that is so far afield from where we are, needs to take a lot of time and deliberation to figure out just exactly what the consequences would be. But the theory, I think, is excellent. And I think that because as government does not shrink very well by itself. In fact, it has a tendency to grow over time. And if you've heard some of the horror stories of the people who work for the federal government doing something that's already been stopped over here, spending lots and lots of money to create something that they've already decided they're not going to go to the next step. It's because the right hand doesn't know what the left hand's doing. Now, we're not a big federal government here at the state level, but I believe there are such things that do happen with us as well. If someone is not get the message, so we're not doing this anymore over here, and this is a waste of time. What this does to me is if I were governor, I would love to have this as a mandate. Because it would tell me just exactly who is in my payroll, which is the entire state, who should be continuing to do what they're doing and who shouldn't, and what other better ways there might be to do that job. I think this is an excellent tool. I can understand that the unions would have some interpretation. I think in the end result, when it came time to union negotiations, if this had been done for a few years, we wouldn't be fighting the battle we're fighting now over union contracts. I think this is an eye-opener for the public and the legislature and the administration to be able to review just exactly who is within their power. So whether it's exact language in this piece of legislation or not, the theory of this, I think, is excellent. So anyway, Marco, you have something you want?
Madam Chairman, if I may, for the record, this is Marco Pignalver from Representative Cowder's office, and I just wanted to address Representative Hudson's concern about that subparagraph B on page 5, lines 6 through 11. Madam Chairman, actually, that's superfluous language. We've already talked about taking that out. Really what that says, and I'm afraid it's been misconstrued, it simply says that if the agency is going to go out to contract, it must follow the procurement statute as it is. It adds no additional burden on labor contracts or anything else. If this committee wanted to take that paragraph B out of there, you wouldn't really be changing the content of it.
Well, isn't it true that we, with most of the union contracts anyway, that there is a provision that if you do want to go to privatization, which is, this is talking about replacing what you're doing here with a private sector, is what I think they're talking about, that you have to do a comparison and you have to come up with a certain amount of cost savings and you have to do all that that's in the union contract. Isn't that true?
That's right. Just as the language in the union contracts, which requires a feasibility study and cost analysis prior to going to privatizing state jobs.
What line would that, Madam Chair, Marco, what line would that be? Page 5, what line?
You're looking at subparagraph B on page 5, which is the paragraph you referred to earlier.
It's
it
on line 6.
Change. This does, this statute, this bill, rather, doesn't change the requirement to follow the what's in the union contracts. We're just saying that if you contract out, you follow the state procurement code. You have to do it anyway, so you could take this out because it really is redundant.
Thank you. Representative Cotullo?
Marco, just for a second, what about A then? Why is A there under the procurement of listed activity? Is that just a restatement as well? It's starting page 4, line 29.
The reason that's in there is to require the cost comparison of all the reasonable and fair costs, because what the private sector always wants, and what legislature wants to know, is what does it cost to perform a certain activity? If you put something out for bid, you know what the private sector is going to charge you because that's your bid response. But what we don't know is what it's really costing the state, and you have the question of how to handle indirect costs. And that's one of the things that this bill will require, is that you have to consider the fair and reasonable cost, or which most people will interpret as indirect costs.
Let me give you a good example of what happens, I think. When I wanted to get the Taylor Highway open this year, because of the need to be able to get the things that were going over that highway, and I was trying to figure out how to do it, and it wasn't in the budget. And one of the things that I did is I have a very aggressive person in my area who does that kind of work. And so I said, look, if we can't get in the budget, maybe we can get the money from someplace else. Maybe we can get some money from some of these people who are transferring things up there. Maybe we can get some money. Would you go and see if you could do that? Sure, I'll do that. And so he did. He was very familiar with it. He went and did with it. He talked to the people who work for DOT up there, found out what was in the budget for doing it. He says, I can't do it for that. says, go ahead and have, if you can get the money for them, have them do it. I can't do it for that. And I think that you'll find a lot of times that that is what's going to come out in the end, is that you can't do it for that. That doesn't be the most important thing that I want to look at here, is should we be doing this at all? That's the question that I have. Should we be doing it at all? And if it is determined as a public policy we should be doing these things, then the next step might be, should we do it by contracting out or do it by state employees? But I can tell you, I don't know why attorneys work for the state unless they really love their job, because they could make a lot more money working somewhere else. You know, I
want to run for public office.
Well,
and work for less.
Yeah. Anyway, you know. So having said all that, I really like this concept. I think I'm excited about this concept, but I don't see the same problems that you all see about this. I think it is a management tool that could be maximize the public's confidence in state government.
Madam Chairman, if I may, the difference in the views expressed by people on this committee is exactly the strength of the bill, because it will generate debate and public discussion about the activities that ought to be on the list and ought not to be on the list. And that's the kind of discussion that is healthy and that we want to have, as well as the costs associated with them. So there will be debate. This is a debate-generating bill, which we...